session number 22658, reel 6.
Whereas the Australians weren't under the direct command of the British command, whereas you had General Brahmi and the likes, that if they thought things weren't going right, would report back to our own Prime Minister and indicate, they in turn would indicate their displeasure of us being used for things that they consider they shouldn't be, whereas take the New Zealanders, they just have to do and go where they were told to go. And that was the difference between the New Zealanders and us. So Blamey was through Curtin and the likes, caused a bit of a commotion about Crete, because I understand that he didn't recommend that they go there. Of course, they did go there, and of course, well, they ran into all the problems. And I think also Blamey through Curtin had us withdrawn out of the Alamein show in November, mainly because of the Japanese movements. And prior to that, there were the other divisions that were on their way home prior to us. But that's all I can say in regards to my thoughts on.
And your position then of sergeant at that point, mm-hmm. What was it like to be receiving lectures on how to fight a war? Sort of going to school to learn the techniques of war. What was that like in preparation for your later?
With those in particular, I can't say that I really I'm just trying to think of.
You've been mentioning that you were being given lectures by the X-Men, and you were talking about this and that and how to lie down properly and everything. You haven't actually sort of seen any battle at this stage.
No.
What was it like to be receiving this sort of instruction on how to perform?
I think, as far as I was concerned, it was a case of for you to learn, the only people would be those that have had experience in actual combat, or were responsible for a particular action to be undertaken, and you would have been taken through the various processes of action or logistics of what was going to happen. But with if there were certain procedures in which the powers to be or a method of how to undertake a particular action. Well, I mean, that was the way you had to do it because of you were being led in some way or another, and there was no use digressing from what the intention was.
You changed not only from, well, you received your rank, but you changed units as well, I understand. Can you tell us what that involved?
Yes. Basically, it was all brought about in Tobruk. The anti-tank companies, there were three anti-tank companies to a division, one for each brigade, and they were under the direct command of the brigadier. Whereas also in the division there was an anti-tank regiment which was responsible for the anti-tank protection of whatever action that they were involved in, but they didn't have any direct command over the anti-tank companies unless there was a direction from above to say that the regiment was in charge of the whole area's anti-tank protection. And though I haven't any facts on it, I understand that there were problems in regards to Tobruk of coordination between the companies and the regiment. So it was decided that they would, when they came out of Tobruk, that the companies would be amalgamated into the regiment. Now, the regiment had 48 guns, and when they brought in the anti-tank companies, they ended up as a 64-gun regiment. So that's how it happened, and being a reinforcement to the 24th, we were then taken, transferred to the artillery what the heck they called, RAA, Royal Australian Artillery. So we were transferred from Mugazi to a camp called New Surat. And I still held the three stripes to go across there. And whilst I was there, and the troops had come out of Tobruk, and after a bit of acclimatisation, they set up anti-tank schools because of new weaponry and from what they'd learnt in Tobruk was the foundations of anti-tank warfare. So they started these schools in Palestine, and I was lucky enough to be sent to it, though I never had any anti-tank training at all. And so on the opening night of the school, they set us a questionnaire. I read through this and I thought, well, what I do know a bit about artillery, I'm not going to divulge it here, sort of business. So I paraded myself to whoever was in charge of the scrutineer or whatever he may be. I explained to him that I'd been in infantry training and I knew nothing about any tank weaponry or warfare. And he said, well, you go back and do the best you can. So that's what I did. So I was behind the eight ball with these other fellows that were mainly X-Men and that. But then,
what did it say about the command and the concern they may have had in teaching their men properly the tactics of war if they were telling you to go and do the best you could?
Well, that was the only way he'd find out how much I knew, and then he would be comparing my end results to what I started off with, let's say nothing, whereas these other blokes they might be 20% better off than I was, or 50%. So he would know that by their answers, where I knew nothing, and when we had finished and they had to make a personal assessment of each person, well, I qualified, so that's that was sufficient enough for me. But I don't know how to answer that question.
How then did the school progress?
It was very a rigid school. In artillery work, and particularly if there's, you know, as far as drills were concerned, because they were producing instructors to go back to their regiments and set up a procedure that had been laid down, by the powers to be, and just take gun drill, and you would never walk across a gun park. Gun park being an area where the guns were stationed, and you'd be on the double. And if you get from one side to the other and you strolled across, well, you'd get a 21 gun salute. And so the gun drill was always on the double, and those sorts of things were expected of you to go back, and the same sort of was supposed to apply in in your regiment, because the gun park's sacred ground. That's only just an idea of there were rigid rules and things that you had to abide by, but when you got into action plans and how to go about sighting guns and things of that nature, that was you can't lay down any procedure because you've got the land that you've got to deal with, but you're given various different situations. And
what about specific training with the guns? What did that involve?
Well, apart from your gun drill, I mean, you had to know the workings of the guns. And, I mean, if you had certain... let's say that the projectile or the shell... you had to take the shell out and it hadn't been fired, and there's fire drills the recuperators didn't work, or you couldn't get the wheels onto because the wheels on the 2 pounders that we were using, you could take them off and they used to drop on the ground, you see, so that they all had to be lifted up and someone put the wheels on and all those sorts of things. But you were taught, see, under normal circumstances, you'd have what they call an artificer. He, if anything went wrong with the gun, well, you'd call him him. But if he's not, you only got one to a battery or something like that. Well, there are occasions when you had to do some of those repairs yourself, plus the fact of the gun sights and that after firing would get out of alignment, it had to be recalibrated and things of that nature. Well, you learnt those sorts of things, the maintenance of your...
Actual firing of the gun, how often did you get an opportunity to do that?
Not so much in the training, though in the units they used to have range practicing and things of that nature. But if you're an NCO, it's not very often that you would. I mean, you'd now and again you'd have a gun, but so the gun layers are the ones that are. And the gun crews are the ones that would get all the practice and firing when it was necessary. They were the ones. Because what used to happen in the gun drill, everybody would, what they call, change round. There'd be the number two, three and four. Well, four would become two. And so on like that, he'd be the gun layer, so that everybody knew every position on the gun, so that if somebody got knocked off or injured or left or got promotion, three would take twos, or whoever's the best bloke around sort of business. And then the other point is you've got your tractor to pull or carry the gun, and you've got your driver as well. So those are the sort of things.
How long then were you in Palestine before you went off to Syria?
Well, I better go through another step.
Okay.
When I eventually got to at Christina, I became a gunner. So...
What did that mean for you?
I knew I was going to go back because I was a Voyager Army Sergeant. So I knew I had to go, so I thought, well, that's it. So it didn't worry me. I ended up back with a lot of X-Men, or in a tent of eight. There were five X-Men and three reinforcements, and I was in the reinforcements, I was the only West Australian. The other two were New South Welshmen, but on the other five were all West Australians, X-Men. So they gave us a bit of hurry up, wanted to know why it took so long to join up. Did we couldn't hear the bugle, or did remarks like that? So they gave us a bit of, you know, smartness up a bit.
Okay. So you were a gunner?
Yeah.
And then what? Then you went to Syria?
No. There was some movement in our own particular troop, which was a West Australian, mainly West Australians. The troop sergeant or at that time the elderly fellows, you know, they were around about 40s and things like that, they were made, some of them were made B class, and some of them were 45 or something like that. They made them B class, so they all went off to various jobs in Tel Aviv and things of that nature, canteens, post or pay. So there were some were NCOs, so there became some vacancies. So there was a vacancy for the left left section sergeant, and the next moment I'm told I've got it. So I paraded myself again, and I said, but I didn't think it was fair, and why couldn't somebody, the ex-fellas, get it because of their action? Anyway, that didn't wash. But mainly because I'd done the school, and there might have been, for the whole regiment, half a dozen sergeant who had done the, was in the school. Well, you know, when you think of 1,000-odd men, six. So that was probably the reason why I was promoted up to a sergeant.
So you didn't want the promotion, really?
Yeah, it would be temporary and then it would be confirmed. So from there, I just had to buckle down and have a bit of a more confined life. When I was in the New Surat training camp, there were some ex-men there, and they said, "You blokes will have to smarten yourself up when you get up to the regiment, the discipline, and you know, you better be very careful what you do and say." What a joke!
Why was it a joke?
Well, I reckon I've said it a lot of times that these fellows were all individualists. They were a gun crew of five or six, or six and the driver, and they were in action by themselves. Four guns in a troop, they'd be separated. Each gun would depend on the circumstances. It could be 1,000 yards apart or something like that, or less, depending on what the layouts were. And they cooked for themselves. The chap in charge of the gun was a fella that decided whether he was going to open fire or he didn't open fire. There were the troop commander was responsible for the whole of the troop, but I mean he didn't have direct command over in the actual action. The blokes, the number one was the first that decided whether he's going to fire or he wasn't going to fire, sort of business, and they left on their own. And I mean rationing and general administration of the troop was done through the troop commander and the troop sergeant, sort of business. And they saw that everything was running, and all those sort of things, but the actual, they were all individuals, the others were. And of course, when they'd been 6 months like that in Tobruk and things like that, and when they came out, it'd be like trying to round up 1,000 scrub bulls and get them to do things that you wanted them to do. So it was a bit not like an infantry battalion, whereas they're under direct command all the time, sort of business.
Can you tell us when you went to Syria, what the situation there was and how that came about?
Yeah, well, around about January, the 7th Division was in Syria, and they moved off to go back to Australia. We took their place, and that would be in probably in January.
Did you feel that you might be heading off to Australia at some stage as well?
Well, there was always that sort of a furphy around. Normally they wouldn't, you know, the powers that be tried to hide where you were going, mainly for, you know, theoretically for to confuse the enemy type of business, but all the locals that knew what was going on, I mean the local villagers, we eventually went up to Tripoli, that's in Lebanon, well it was called Syria then, where it was always Lebanon, but we were posted to a camp called Basama up in the mountains, and just outside Tripoli.
Did you know what you were there for?
Oh yes, because it was expected that the Germans would parachute into Syria,
yeah.
And the most logical place for them to parachute in would have been these marshes, and it was flat area, swampy area in north of Tripoli. So there were fortifications built into the mountains while the 7th was there, and we just took over those placements, and we at times moved out of Basama, which was our regimental camp, and lived up in the mountains.
What were those conditions like?
Well, we just had ordinary army tent situations, and they were building accommodation in the backs of these dug into the mountains and made of the local stone accommodation, like a big room sort of business, which we, whilst we were on in action, we'd be living in these were real concrete bunker type situations, which we could put our guns inside, and they'd be camouflaged and things like that. But we had to do the work, though we had local employees on the stonework and things like that. So that's what we were doing there for quite a period. And the infantry, they were up in the mountains as well. Well, the whole division was positioned into the mountains, I think, basically to control the marsh areas.
At this stage, did you know what the real threat of Germany coming in was?
Oh, well, we expected them. We did expect them. Expect it to happen. Thank goodness it didn't. It was from there that we were to do the brigade box exercise out on the Homs Desert, and we only had 16 guns when we should have had 64. So it meant that one battery would use the 16 guns, and when the other, when they came back, we took over, and we only had 16 guns, 16 portes, portes being trucks that would, could carry the guns on the tabletop.